Grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, courage to change things I can't, and wisdom to know the difference. Our speaker is being recorded with his or her permission. CD can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Duke.
Hi, my name's Duke. I'm an alcoholic. I really like alcohol a lot. I remember when I had a year and a half of sobriety, and someone asked me to speak at an AA meeting, and it was my first AA meeting that I ever spoke at, and I was really nervous, and I asked my sponsor about it, and my sponsor told me, he said, you just need to remember that the most important thing about speaking in an AA meeting isn't that you say the perfect thing or that you look perfect. He said the most important thing about speaking, he said the reason why we speak at an AA meeting is so we can get chicks. So, totally worked for me. I hooked up with that one right there. So, yeah, that was good. I'm an uncomfortable person, and especially like when I don't have AA, and if I don't have alcohol, I'm very uncomfortable with myself, and I'm mostly just thinking, and then I start thinking about what you're thinking, but then I'm start thinking about what you're thinking I'm thinking. And I'm not thinking that. So screw you. I'm uncomfortable without alcohol. There was a time in high school when everything was working, and I went to a party, and it was one of those parties where there's a bunch of people there, and but I saw this one girl from the other end of the room, and this was a junior year in high school. It was like one of those relationships where like our eyes locked from the other end of the room, and the stars aligned, and the God said, "Duke, this is the girl meant for you." And she went out with me for 3 months, and I went out with her for 5 years. So that gets pretty uncomfortable, and I need fast-acting pain relief. And for me, that comes in the form of beer and hard alcohol and anything else after that. So high school, I started, my dad was an alcoholic. And he died, I think, when he was like 47. The doctor told him he had like a mild heart attack, and the doctor said, "If you keep drinking, you're going to die." And he didn't stop, and so eventually he died of alcoholism when I was 12. And when he was alive, he said, "I don't want anybody to be sad when I die. I want you to throw a big party at my funeral and just remember the good times." So all of his friends threw this big party on a yacht out in San Francisco. And that was the first time that I got drunk. I puked off the side of the boat. And I loved it. It was awesome. And, you know, it's hard to get alcohol in junior high. So I just did a bunch of other stuff until I found it in high school. And then I got in a band. I was like in a really cool band and stuff. And we're like going to make it all the way. And it's fun to drink when you're in a band, and then we thought we were like Led Zeppelin, so we would like trash people's houses after we played, after they invited us to play at their house, and we were all drunks in the band. We were like this like Dave Matthews type band, but one day someone gave the lead singer a line of meth and an Iron Maiden album. And so he stopped wanting to sing like Dave Matthews and just wanted to yell like a lot of vibrato and drink a lot of vodka, and he would just get wasted. We're like trying to play like classic rock, and he's like wearing like spandex, and so like that, a lot of tension and stuff while we were getting drunk with the band, and he was like ruining my life. And then the lead guitarist was this awesome guitar player that played like insane like Jimmy Page guitar solos, but his family was Mormon, and I don't know how much you know about Mormon families, but they don't care for Jimmy Page guitar solos. So they told him that if he didn't go on a mission, they were going to disown him. So he totally ruined my life, too. And I hate religious people and Mormons because they don't understand that I'm trying to make it. So a lot of that led to more drinking. And then there came a time when drinking was just, it wasn't wacky, crazy, or zany anymore. And it just stopped being fun. And that was when I... What happened was I was in San Francisco, and we were like, our band was like going to play this like frat party, and so because my friend was in this frat at Berkeley, so I was the first one in the band to show up, and the frat like pays me the money, and then I'm just sitting there, and like it's like after the football game, and the place just gets completely packed, and then the rest of the band just never shows up. And so I'm just sitting there, like, kind of in the corner, like, yelling at my friend who booked me. And then I just kind of backed out of the house and went to the bar and bought everyone drinks with the money that I earned from my band not playing at the frat party. And then after I got wasted, I remember I went to go see that girl that I was going out with that wasn't going out with me. And like we went to her house like late at night, and she was having a party at her house, and we got there like after the party was over, and one of my friends like got naked, and because he was crazy, and then like tried to jump in her roommate's bed, and that wasn't good, and then he came running into the kitchen, and he started going through this girl's purse, and he pulled out all this cash. And I grabbed the cash from him. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And then she walks into the room and sees me with all the cash. And she goes, get out of here. I hate you. I'm like, it wasn't me. And I put the cash back in the purse, and then I was completely crushed. I was like, I never want to see you again, and that was my fake girlfriend. So I was completely crushed at that point, and that was when I made a decision to quit drinking. It was that, and I got a DUI, so the court said to do it too. And but I said right after the holidays. So then I proceeded to get drunk every night with all my friends and tell them how much I was telling everyone that I was going to quit drinking. So they better enjoy me now, because this isn't going to last. I'm going to quit, you know, so I'm really fun to party with. You should just enjoy me now. And then I would talk to them about how, like, when I do get sober, I'm going to get a sponsor, work all the steps and stuff. And people that are drinking don't want to talk about sponsors or the steps. So I really wasn't that fun to party with. And then New Year's came and went. And I had told so many people that I was going to quit drinking that I felt like, what will people think of me? Because that's one of the things I really care about, what other people think of me. And I was told everyone that I was going to quit drinking, so what will they think of me if I don't at least try? And so My last night getting wasted, January 8th, my sobriety date's January 9th, 1995. And the first day, I had all these plans. I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to do the steps. I told everyone when I was drinking that this is what I was going to do. And my first day not drinking, I didn't go to a meeting because I didn't have a car. I didn't have a license. So I didn't really know how to get there. And then my second day, same excuse, I don't have a car. And then my third day, I quit smoking. And I heard that a lot of people smoke in AA, so I should probably hold back for a little bit. And then so I just wasn't going to AA meetings. And I started hanging out with all my old friends and going to parties, drinking parties. But I was sober, and I would drink Snapple, but in a brown paper bag, so it looked like I was drinking. And I don't know. Drinking parties aren't that fun when you're sober, because it's fun like right when you first get there, when everyone's like cracking that first beer, and they're like, "What's up, man? How's it going?" But then later on in the evening, when the guy is saying the same thing that he said to you three times before, only he's like spitting in your face this time, is just, it's not that fun. And I remember, so I was like 90 days sober, hadn't gone to any meetings, and the drummer in my band, I was talking to him, we were like at some club, about to go into some dance club. I don't know why, because I don't really dance or go to clubs. But for some reason, we were going to go to a dance club that night. And right before we were going in, I told him, I said, "Hey, man, I think I can drink again. Maybe I was being a little melodramatic with the whole like quitting forever thing. And I've quit for 90 days. I think I can do it." And my friend, this is a friend who's not in AA. He should be, but he's not. And he says to me, he says, "Dude, you can't start drinking again. Like you're sober for 90 days. He's all, look how far you've come in 90 days. You're doing awesome. You look better. You've written all these killer songs, and you're just doing great. Like you can't quit, or you can't quit sobriety now. You got to keep doing. You're my only hope," he said. And so that really hit me, like, wow, someone who just by not even going to meetings, just setting down the drink for 90 days made that much of a difference. And so I didn't drink that night. Now I'm gonna backtrack for a second. When I grew up in a pretty tough neighborhood, Mission Viejo. And I spent a lot of times on the other side of the tracks, across the Marguerite. And there, that's where, like, My mom never went, so you could just, you know, take off your shirt and start smoking. And we'd smoke in the ditch there. You take off your shirt so your parents don't smell it. And there would be this one kid that lived down there. Everyone was latchkey kids. And this one kid lived down there. He sold marijuana out of his house. And, like, I remember he was, like, 3 years older than me. And we could always hang out at his house and, like, smoke cigarettes in the house. His mom let him smoke cigarettes in the house and stuff. And I remember this guy. We would buy marijuana off of him. And I remember seeing him as the years progressed, his alcoholism, like, progressed, and him getting wasted. And I just remember, like, one day him in the garage. This is, like, you know, 3 years older. When you're in, like, junior high, like, 3 years older is a lot. And, like, seeing him, like, all wasted and, like, I don't know. I was going to tell a stupid story. Never mind. It was gross. We're glad I didn't. Anyways, then fast forward to, like, when I was a senior in high school and my band played out in Wildomar, and we were camping with, like, 30 kids that all took way too much LSD. And that guy that used to sell me drugs in junior high was there, and he had taken way too much. And I brought my cooler there for refreshments. And someone had the smart idea to bring an axe for the firewood. And this guy that's kind of now crazy is got a hold of the axe, and he's taken too much hallucinogens. And he's walking around with the axe with this, like, psycho evil look in his eye. And he starts walking around like this going, "I'm going to kill someone." And I was like, "Oh shit, I just want to trip out on the fire." And he's, like, walking around, and eventually he killed my cooler with the axe. And that's when I had to get out of there. The guy was, like, evil in his eyes. I saw it. And fast forward back to this night. I'm 90 days sober. I haven't gone to any AA meetings. I don't even know how to get to AA meetings. But I know how to, like, hang out at dance clubs with drinkers. And the very next day, this dude that was going to kill someone with an axe calls me. And he says, "Hey, Duke, I heard you were looking for some work. I got some construction work for you." So I start working with him, and it turns out this guy's sober for 2 years. And, that whole thing in high school was like 4 years before or whatever. So this time, at this point, he's sober for 2 years. I start doing construction work with him. And he's like, he picks me up in the morning, he drops me off, and he starts telling me about AA. And then he starts taking me to meetings, and he started introducing me to people. And he became my sponsor. And I remember seeing, like, when he was dropping me off from work, I remember looking in his eyes, and there's, like, a look that in AA's people's eyes, like, I remember seeing this love in his eyes and thinking, if AA could do that for him, because I remember this guy was freaking out of his mind, psycho, crazy, evil. And if it can change it from that to this love that I saw in his eyes, then there's got to be something to it. So I started going to AA with him. Now, the one problem with my sobriety in the beginning is that, one, I was young. I was 21 years old when I first got to AA, and I just wasn't that bad of an alcoholic. So that meant, because I wasn't that bad, meant that I really didn't have to do AA that much. Because if you're not bad, in my head, like, you can kind of show up late and leave early. And I remember sitting in the back, and, like, during the breaks, like, no one would be talking to me, and I would just be sitting with my back against the wall thinking, "Why is no one talking to me? This is bull." if I were them, I would totally be talking to me. And so that was like my first year. I never talked at all in my first year. And my first year was all about plans. I enrolled back into Saddleback because I was, when I got into AA, I was like way behind schedule and I needed to catch up. And so it was, I needed to go back to college. And so I was going to go back to college. I enrolled in Saddleback. I'm going to get the girl back. She lives in San Francisco. I'm going to get the band back together. And that was what my first whole year was about. And I was started going to these AA meetings. Like I said, I was like kind of just arriving a little late and leaving right after. I wasn't really hanging out that much. And I remember seeing these one alcoholics that were like kind of really sick alcoholics. And they were like so sick that like they were like sitting up front and raising their hand and stuff. And I mean, doing the discussion and stuff and participating and getting commitments. And I remember thinking like, wow, those guys are pretty messed up. And I wish I was as screwed up as that guy. So then I would have to do AA. But the problem is you got to watch out what you wish for, because it just might come true. And I got a year of sobriety, and I moved to San Francisco. I got accepted into San Francisco State, and everything just started going wrong. I was kind of still in AA, but like when you move, like people do AA wrong when you move. Because everyone does it a little bit different. They just weren't doing it right. And I wasn't really making friends because I didn't like have any of... I didn't know how to do it except for just have your old friend call you and take you. And that wasn't happening up there. And then I had roommates. And they like weren't even doing their dishes. It was like they never even heard of a sponge. And I started failing school. I was like freaking out, getting super stressed out, and the band didn't follow me up there. And I was like pretending that I was friends with the girl of my dreams, but being secretly in love with her. And then she started kissing her actual boyfriend in front of me. And then I was a year sober, and I was more crazy, more screwed up than I ever was when I was drinking. I was so freaking messed up a year sober. I was out of my mind. And I started having these heart palpitations and a crazy feeling. And I thought my mind was going insane. And I thought I was having a heart attack. And I checked myself into the emergency room. And I remember the nurse was like pushing me on the gurney, and this is like a year sober, and I'm in the emergency room on the gurney like going, what the hell happened? What am I doing? This is sober. And I remember thinking to myself that I hadn't really done AA. I hadn't done it like the same way that I drank. I just did, because when I do stuff, I'm like an all or nothing guy, and I didn't do AA all. I was just barely kind of here. And so when I was on that hospital bed, I said, I don't care anymore. I don't care about the roommates, the dishes. I don't care about school. I don't care about the girl. I don't care about the band. I don't care about the shirt on my back. I'm just going to do AA. And that's all I'm going to do. I'm going to throw myself into AA. And it was like right when I hit bottom in sobriety and I made that decision, it was like the universe passionately rearranged itself to show me what to do next. And I went to an AA meeting and I got one of those crazy AA sponsors that has nothing better to do than go to AA. And I just started following him around. And he told me to get a notebook. And he like had me set up this notebook in the beginning. He said, title the beginning page of the notebook, AA Suggestions. And he said, this is where you're going to write down all your AA suggestions. And so he said, here's your first suggestions. I want you to write these three things down. One, it's not fair. Two, it's not going to go your way. And three, you're not going to get what you want. So he said, once we get that out of the way, we'll get along a lot better. These are the rules. He said, the trick is can you learn to live with the rules? So he started giving me all these suggestions to write down in that notebook. He said to arrive at an AA meeting 15 minutes early, and he told me to stay 15 minutes late, and he told me to sit in the front row. He said, that's the intensive care unit. You're a sick alcoholic, and you need to be there. And I never raised my hand once in an AA meeting, and he told me to raise my hand in every single AA meeting, even if I didn't know what to say. And he told me to go to a meeting every day. And he said, go to the same meetings. Go to make one of your meetings a big book study. Make one of your meetings a 12 and 12. And he, I just started following him around. And I would raise my hand in the air, like when it was time to talk. And I would just say, my name's Duke, I'm an alcoholic, and my sponsor told me to talk. And then that's it. And I would just do it like every meeting. And then he also told me to bring my notebook to every meeting. And he said, if I ever heard anything good in an AA meeting, to write it down in a notebook. And I remember asking him, how come no one else has notebooks? So I started bringing this notebook around. But he said that the thing is you hear so much good things in AA, but you only remember what you remember, and you forget the rest. So write it down. And he told me it's like panning for gold, and you're going to get little nuggets, and just start writing this stuff down. So I was like the one dude with my notebook, like cruising around, writing down stuff. And at home, I have like 15 notebooks now from like the first 3 years of just writing a ton of stuff down. And now it's just all like stuck in my head. And I started doing the steps with him, and we went through the fourth step, and I just wanted to blame everyone, like wanted to blame the lead singer because he wanted to do meth and scream instead of just drink beer and sing like a normal person, a normal lead singer in a classic rock band. I hated him. He ruined my life. And the Mormon dude and the whole freaking Mormon church, screw those guys. And that's as far as I got, was screw you. And I learned in the fourth step that there's more than just screw you. There's also like your part. And part of that was just like being this victim, you know, like I'm the victim. Everyone does this to me, you know, like instead of just like becoming my own, I don't know, band or something, you know, like I'm blaming everyone else and it's all these people's fault and relying on other people. And I also like had this thing where I like thought that I wasn't good enough. And I thought that I was less than. And that's one of the cool things that I learned after doing the fourth and fifth step and going through the sixth and seventh step. In the seventh step is when it says, talks about, God, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. And my sponsor said, that's if God's willing to take all of me, the good parts and the bad parts, then maybe I can start accepting myself as well, the good parts and the bad parts. If God's willing to accept me for who I am right now, just the whole package, maybe I could just be easy on myself and not beat myself up so much and accept who I am. And my sponsor started talking about humility, and he said that humility means not being greater than anyone, but not being less than anyone too. And being, he said, that's a pretty good deal for you because like most people are above you. So, says it means being like equal to everyone, And he would give me, like, my sponsor was rad. He was also, like, some might say crazy, but aren't we all crazy? This is not Well Persons Anonymous. If you hang out here long enough, you're going to meet some pretty sick people. But luckily we have the steps to get through that. But yeah, my sponsor was pretty sick. He also liked to party as well. And but he got AIDS from having gay sex. But he's like totally straight. And he's in sobriety with full blown AIDS. He got it in like 1989 or whatever, and so it's like a death sentence. Then he thinks he's gonna die, and when I get him, like, he's like 6 years sober. He's the type of guy who he really likes to fall in love with people, like women. The gay thing was just like a drunk thing that he liked to do. He wasn't really that into it in sobriety, but that's enough about that. I don't know why I'm saying. Anyways, he told me about his first year in AA. He was in, I think he was in 10 two-week relationships where he was completely in love. Everyone. And so he's like one of those serial monogamists. He always has to have a girlfriend. So I got really lucky because his girlfriend just dumped him right when I got him. So I got him like in between girlfriends, and he like really got to focus on me and stuff. But he was like, he thought he was going to die. He ended up, he hated tattoos. But he ended up, he was scared of them because he thought that if he got one, maybe he would get them everywhere. So he never got any tattoos till he was like 32. And then like his first tattoo, that he made a turkey with those electric turkey gun things. He turned into his own tattoo gun, and he tattooed his lips and then his eyebrows. He shaved his head, shaved all the hair off of his body. Lips, eyebrows, first tattoos. Second, hands. Then just his whole face and his whole body, everything. So it was kind of true. Once he got one, he just went for the whole thing. And he told me that he heard in AA that you can't save your face and your ass at the same time. So he just cut off his whole face with tattoos. And so he just like threw himself into AA completely. So that's the kind of craziness that we're dealing with. But that slash AA spiritual genius, and he gave me all these tools, and he would give me all these great analogies, and he would because he thought he was going to die, he had to learn how to live with himself, get comfortable in this body, get as relaxed as possible to try to live longer, to live in the now. He really taught me how to live for today. He taught me that one of his things was, he said, live like you have like 6 months to live. Because if you have 6 months to live, you're going to do everything that you want to do, but you'll still like make your bed and stuff. So if you have like one day, you'll say F it to everything. And when we got to the seventh step, he said that when God, like after your fourth and fifth step, when you're ready to give God all your character defects, he said it's like this, you have this car, and it's like this classic car, like a 1964 and a half convertible Mustang or something, and you've really let it go. And it's gotten to the point where like you have duct tape on it, and you've just been taking it to like the mechanic, like who works out of his garage down the street and really doesn't know what he's doing, and it's just completely effed up. That's your car. And when you get, instead, you're going to bring this car, instead of to that crappy mechanic, you're going to take it back to the original manufacturer. That's God. And it isn't like he's going to like soup it up or anything, but he's going to bring it back to stock condition. And so that was his analogy for the steps. And that's what God's doing in the sixth and seventh step. And in the eighth step, that's when you're thinking of all the people that you harmed in your life, And the way that my sponsor described that to me was, it's just think of anyone in your life, anyone that you would not be comfortable with. He said, imagine that you're on the bus, because in San Francisco, we took the bus a lot. Imagine you're on the bus, and imagine every person in your life coming on that bus. Would you be like, oh, God, I don't want to see that person, like hiding behind the paper? Or would you be like, oh, I love that person? So all the people that you don't want to see, they go on the amends. And you make amends to all those people that you're uncomfortable with. And what the ninth step does is it makes you a free man. You're a free man where you don't have to cross the street anymore to avoid anybody. You're a free man to walk wherever you want. You're a free man to be comfortable with whoever you want. And the rest of the steps are just maintaining all that and giving it away. He said that you can't keep it unless you give it away. And so one day my sponsor was telling me, he said, hey, Duke, I don't like the way that you're dressing. I think that maybe I was wearing some bell bottoms with holes in them from the thrift store or something. And he said, we're going to go to your house. And he came over to my house one day and he had these big hefty trash bags. And he said, we're going to go through your closet. My closet was like packed with all these clothes that I didn't even really like. And he said, we're going to go through each article of clothing. And if you haven't worn that article of clothing in a year, it's out of there. But he said, I'm going to look at each article of clothing and I'm going to say, do you like this? And if I say maybe or I don't know, then we throw it out. But if I say F yes, I love that shirt, then we keep it. So he started going through my closet and he started saying, do you like this? And I would say, I don't know, out. Do you like this? Maybe. We're throwing it out. Do you like this? F yeah, I like that. Okay, we're keeping it. And after that day, I learned this huge lesson. I learned that there's a saying, nature abhors a vacuum. And what that means is that if there's a space, nature wants to fill it up. But if my space, if my closet is all filled up with maybes and I don't knows, there's no room for any of the good stuff to come. So I learned that I have to get rid of all the maybes and the I don't knows to make room for the F yeahs. And that was an awesome lesson that I learned in my life. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take this into my love life. And so I started just going up to chicks going, so are you my girlfriend? And they would say, I don't know you. And I would say, you know, that sounds like a maybe or I don't know. I'm out of here. And then eventually I, once again, the universe rearranged itself and the F yeah girl came into my life. And she was here last week. She said we met in her band called the Blackouts. And we started dating and we made our own band. And my wife, Leslie, plays bass and I played guitar. And we started singing harmonies together. And we got this drummer, Bob, the Bobinator. And we were in this three-piece band. And and it was awesome. And we just started we started having fun in life. And we were both 2.5 years sober, going to a bunch of AA meetings. And my wife, she really wanted to get married. So finally, after 3 years, she gave me a ring to give to her. And then I was like, okay, you know, we've been dating for 3.5 years. I gave her, I proposed to her. And then the very next day, she came home with 3 wedding magazines. And we really got to work on planning that wedding. And we had this huge wedding. It was a sober wedding with half like AA people and half of my drunk friends who made their own bar out in the side alley and did cocaine in the bathroom in front of my sponsee. And but it was an awesome wedding. And then I totally had sex with my wife and then she had a baby. And then we did it again and she had another baby. And I started taking the kids to an AA meeting, and my youngest son learned how to clap in the AA. And then we moved from San Francisco down here. And in San Francisco, you do not have a good program if you don't say the F word. But in Southern California, you're not allowed to do that. And I have a knack for making people really uncomfortable. As much as I don't like to talk, I have a knack for making other people uncomfortable and angry at me. And so I came down here, and that happened because I would like to say the F word, and then people would like to tell me that that's not right. And then I got the secretary commitment at a meeting, and they wanted me to wear a tie, but I don't wear ties, and that makes people uncomfortable. And then I had all my speakers not wear ties, and then they had a whole business meeting about how that can never happen again. And then I said, screw these guys, I'm starting my own meeting. And if you look in the AA schedule, every single meeting was started on a resentment. Exactly like that. Every single meeting was started because the other guys, screw them. We're going to do it right. And so I started my own meeting on Saturday nights, and it's a talk show meeting that me and my sponsor started like 12 years ago. We wanted to start a fun meeting on Saturday nights, and we said, you know what? The two reasons why people go out in sobriety is either finance or romance. And we're probably never going to have any money. So let's focus on the romance thing. And so we would get these speakers and say, hey, talk about relationships in sobriety. And then the speaker would get up there, but he would just say his AA share. And he wouldn't talk about relationships in sobriety. So then my sponsor and I started brainstorming, how can we force them to talk about relationships in sobriety? And he said, well, what if we did an interview? And then I said, yeah, like a David Letterman show. We'll have a sidekick. And then we're like, yeah, we'll have a top 10 list. And then it just evolved over the years. And then when I moved down here, I started it again. And then a bunch of people got pissed off too. So, but screw it. Because that, you know what? AA is the universal wrench. It fits all nuts. And that meeting is the wrench that fits this nut. So I love it. And I, because of AA and because of the 12 steps, I've had a spiritual awakening. And I've had some of the choices I've made in life, in sober life, have caused me a lot of pain and my wife. But when you look at the big picture, I have had a beautiful life, and I have a beautiful woman, and I have two beautiful kids, and I'm doing in life what I want to do. I think the steps are here to make you the man that you are meant to be. And if you're not doing what you want to do, and if you're not headed towards the person you want to be, you can change that, and you can do it in sobriety. And because of the 12 steps, I've had a spiritual awakening. I've been able to do that. Thank you. Thank you.